Welcome back to Tesla's Radio. If you're new to the show, my name is Marissa True. And for you regular listeners, you know the drill. On this show, we bring together the people within our Tesla's community that are making an impact. And on today's episode, I'd love to welcome Richard Entrep. Richard, how are you?
Hey, Marissa. Nice to see you.
Richard, you are quite the multi-hyphenate. You are a senior advisor of enterprise innovation at KPMG USA. You are a general startup advisor and investor and a former prominent senior tech executive at brands many of us are familiar with, like Verizon, Christie's, Time Warner, and MoMA, at the very least. And you are also a physical and digital art collector. So there's a lot that feeds into your background, which is what makes you a very interesting brain to pick today. But given there is so much for us to unpack, we will start with the bare basics. We will start where we usually start off, which is your journey into blockchain. So can you please share your story with us?
Sure. I first found blockchain technology while I was a global CIO at Christie's Auction House, late 2017. We were conducting the Ebsworth collection, which was a sale from Bernie Ebsworth, a very prominent collector. Mr. Ebsworth had passed. His daughter at the time was putting his art collection up for sale, which consisted of a number of just tremendous masterpieces. The total sale was probably in the $400 million range. And we had partnered with a company called Artery at the time, which was a blockchain for the art world company. And the incentive was not to create NFTs way before NFTs had even been introduced to the traditional art world. The intention of that sale being blockchain based, which was the first blockchain auction, actually, was to validate the provenance and the sales and basically record the sales within Hyperledger blockchain. So nothing to do with crypto or NFTs or residual royalties. It was more about, again, documenting the sale, the provenance of the art, and to the credit of Mr. Ebsworth's daughter and her husband at the time, they drove us to actually ensure that that collection had a blockchain component to it. So that was the first one. At that same time, Christie's had kicked off at Christie's Art and Tech Conference that we had put together with several folks within the organization. And we brought together, you know, I think the old art world and a large number of new collectors in the new art world. Again, this is July of 18. Was it 17? 2018, sorry. And that was the first art and tech conference focused on blockchain and the art world. We had just sold the first AI piece of art at the time. And so a lot of this was, the discussion was starting back then. So that's kind of how I got into this. The blockchain conference at that time was very interesting. A very common mutual friend of ours, Jason Bailey, aka Art Gnome, actually introduced NFTs to the art world at that conference. And that conference also included 200 favors, which were the Lost Robbies, Robbie Barrett, an artist at the time, I think he was 17 or 18, had produced a number of AI images that were free NFTs, basically, from Super Rare. And I think only 20 of the 200 were redeemed ever. And now they're known as the Lost Robbies, those cards, because they've been auctioned off at Christie's and Sotheby's for millions of dollars, or close to $1 million each, which is a pretty interesting story and fun fact about those lost artworks. So that's kind of my background on NFTs and blockchain in the art world.
It's super interesting because I think many people assume that NFTs and the art world really kicked off with the Beeple sale that was in 2021, if I remember rightly.
That's right.
And so to hear about how this was all taking place in 2017, much ahead of the curve, and then it was being spearheaded by a traditional art institution like Christie's, goes to show that, you know, that original friction that many people perceive to exist between the traditional art world and the digital art world wasn't necessarily substantiated in the way that I think many people thought. So before we go more into how the traditional world sort of accepted or started to use NFTs or innovate with NFTs, on a personal level, what was it about, you know, for example, Jason's presentation about expertise that really hooked you into your space. What was it about it yourself that gave you the eureka moment about why this was such a significant moment in history?
Yeah, as I mentioned, the intention in 2017-18 wasn't about NFTs or royalties and selling. It wasn't even about digital art, for that matter. It was about provenance and authenticity of physical art. And I was talking to all kinds of startups at the time on how to blockchain physical art. The challenge is still being studied right now with RFID tags, using artists' DNA in the paint of the work product if they're a living painter. That challenge still exists today, how to connect the physical to the digital in the art world. But keep in mind, we had the blockchain auction in 18. We had the first Christie's Art and Tech Conference. 3 years went by before that Beeple sold for $70 million. Before then, nothing was really going on with NFTs or digital art, for that matter. The tipping point, the inflection point, was indeed the Beeple. And the price tag of $70 million got everyone's attention, because the art world is all about how did the sale do, right? It's almost like the art and the artist is secondary. The success metric is the total purse of the sale. The sale did X dollars, or the total combined sales did this. So I think that's what really opened up people's eyes and to realize that this blockchain thing of art, again, that wasn't physical. That was a digital artwork. Before that, digital art really wasn't traded in the big four auction houses. You might have had a Team Labs piece every once in a while pop up. But that was it. There was no digital art being sold in the art market, for that matter, except, again, for a straggler Team Labs type of work. I think the Beeple was that infliction point, and then we know what happened after that, right? So so that's kind of, I think, my perspective on the matter.
So then, to take your storyline into the Tezos community, what was the moment you first were introduced? Am I? Can you hear me?
You're back. Yes.
Great. So to take your storyline to the Tezos community, how did you first come across it? And what was your first impression? And how did you become more involved within this community space?
So Tezos story is interesting. So I had also advised a number of startups in the NFT space over the years. After I left Christie's in 2019, I advised a company called House of First, which did the Royal Society of Players, which were playing cards as NFTs. They did a number of other drops. So I was advising the founder, Zeev Klein, Mr. Pink, who is well known in the NFT community, who's now the chief marketing officer there. So I was dabbling with ETH-based NFTs just to participate in the utility and the, roadmaps of these things, because I was advising companies in that space. But I'm an art collector. I collect physical art as well as digital art. I always felt that Tezos was all about the art first. The prices were much lower, which is an interesting dynamic we can talk about. But, let's face it, the PFPs drove this market, not art. The NFT community, the NFT sales stats, I don't have them at the tip of my tongue anymore. Very small percentage of NFT sales were art or art related. And I don't want to offend anybody that's saying that a Bored Ape or a CryptoPunk isn't art. We'll leave that for another discussion. But there's PFPs and collectibles, 10,000 of something. And then there's art. And I found artists on Tezos to really appeal, where I could actually print them out and hang them up on my wall. I've got, Dolce Pagana work hanging up, Claire Silver, Rafik Anadol, Lawrence Fuller, Jenny Passanen. That work is art to me, physical or digital. And the fact that it's NFT'd is kind of secondary. And Dolce gets upset when I bring this up, because Dolce prefers her work to be NFT first. So it's all subjective, I guess, from a collector's perspective. But I always felt that Tezos was catering to more of the art collectors and less of the folks chasing PFPs and collectibles. And we know how that turned out.
I mean, I agree that there's a very interesting conversation that's taking place between artists who want their NFTs to be presented as, well, their art to be presented as NFTs first versus arts first. But you know, when you were sort of looking into how these conversations were going to relate back onto these traditional art institutions, we spoke already about how back in 2017, 2018, the Innovation and Tech Conference was already speaking about NFTs. But what was the broader attitude or impression towards this technology? There was obviously this quiet period.
From the art world's perspective,
mm-hmm.
there was zero interest. Again, and this may be a dirty secret, but the artery, Christie's artery sale was really driven by the sellers. They wanted a blockchain component to the sale. So following that sale, there was really no real interest in my observation, digital art or subsequent NFT or subsequent blockchain types of sales. We could have drove it, but we didn't. I don't think the demand was there yet. It was still very early, quite frankly. And the divide in that first Christie's Art and Tech Conference was clear, right? There were these very progressive new folks that got it very early on, folks like Anne Bracegirdle, you may know that name. She's been floating around the art world for quite some time. She was in the photo department. She was a champion of this. Elliot Safra, another name that doesn't get mentioned in this space. Those two drove this. They started the conversation 3 years before the Beeple sold. And I've tweeted this out several times. But that was not, you know, this is just a small snippet. Even still, if you look at Sotheby's and Christie's, their NFT sales are snippets of the total $7 or $8 billion that they generate every year. And digital art is also equally as small. And the 70 million Beeple sales are also long gone, I think, to a certain extent. So now we're back to the original intention of this technology being applied to the sector. And that is provenance and authenticity being validated in a mutable way. And that's what blockchain affords the art world at the end of the day, with all the following all the fanfare.
So then after the NFT hype cycle, let's call it, of 2021 and 2022, and then now we have entered into a bear market, what do the attitudes within the art world look like now? Are we still in this sort of experimental phase of interacting with NFTs, or is there still further institutional embrace and study into how this can be continued to be used into the future?
Look, I think the auction houses, I'm not sure what Bonhams and Phillips are doing. If anything, they had a couple of drops years ago, but Christie's and Sotheby's have created separate platforms to sell their NFT sales. I'm not going to speak to the results of those sales. Christie's just had one recently. Sotheby's is continually doing drops. There's been some outlier sales of some Fidenzas and some others that have commanded some pretty serious coin, which is interesting. But that's the blue chip stuff, right? Rafik Anadol's and, you know, Fidenza and Tyler Hobbs. Those are the blue chip NFT artists. They're always going to command, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars each. Rafik may have hit $1 million, I think, for one piece. Beeple still, you know, Beeple had after 5,000 days of 70 million, I think the human one was still significant. It was $30 million. And then following that one, I haven't tracked it in any detail of late. Beeple's, I'm not sure where Beeple sales are now relative to that, but nowhere near that as well. So I think they still have their finger on it. You know, Christie's launched a ventures group to keep their finger on the pulse of the startup community in this space. But I think the PFP collectible thing is done. I think brands, and I'm helping brands in my current role as an advisor, and Web3 is being one of my areas. I think brands still have a great opportunity to engage and convert and retain customers using Web3 blockchain technology for rewards programs. You know, the brands like Nike and Adidas and others, luxury retail brands, are creating digital goods and they're selling them for real commerce, either fiat or crypto. And then you get the advantage of the digital good being an NFT, which means you can buy it and then sell it. And then the original owner, be it a company or a person, gets a royalty on that. And those are all tenets of blockchain: authenticity, provenance, and royalties downstream, which the art world never really, you know, the art world still doesn't support that, right? If George Kondo or Damien Hirst creates a painting, physical painting, he sells it, they sell it once. And then it trickles through the industry, through dealers and auction houses and fairs. If that same work is NFT'd, they can sell it multiple, they can sell it once, but then get a royalty downstream.
So we're talking about the most prominent artists and the most established names within this environment. But then Tezos is obviously home to many more emerging artists that haven't really necessarily built, made names for themselves. So how are these art institutions looking at different art communities across different blockchains? Does the blockchain itself actually matter?
To who, the collector?
Yes.
Absolutely. There are only, I know many whale collectors, they will only collect on Ethereum. And these are whale collectors that have spent the likes of 50, 100,000 plus per piece. You know, I know a big Jenny Passanen collector, Cosimo, the fake Medici guy on Twitter. I think he only collects on, he probably has a Tezos wallet, but he's predominantly Ethereum. There's some Ethereum purists that they just feel that Ethereum commands. Look, the same piece from Dolce or Claire Silver or any of these artists that sell on both platforms, Ethereum and Tezos anyway. We'll talk about Poly and Solana later. The same piece, the same Claire Silver may average, a Claire Silver work on Tezos may average $6,000, $10,000. You know, Claire's gotten tens of thousands of dollars on Ethereum. No one's ever explained that. You and I have had this discussion several times. I don't know why that is. Why does Ethereum command so much more for the same art, same artists than Tezos, pound for pound? That dynamic's never been answered, but it is what it is. And I know a lot of Tezos artists, originally when I started in 2020-21, a lot of those Tezos artists, they wouldn't touch Ethereum. It was the dark side. They were loyal. There was this allegiance, this zealot, you know, allegiance towards Tezos not selling out and being loyal to the art and the artists. And boy, did all of them just fell out to that one. And they all went to Ethereum because the same work that they were getting $3 each for, they could get $3,000 now. So these people make their living at this, so you can't blame them. It's just an interesting dynamic that occurred in my observations.
I think it's always been a very curious question. And the way I liken it in my mind is it's the difference between selling your art in a, let's say, prominent art department store, if there was, versus a smaller boutique gallery. And there's like a difference in the brand or the price premium, which is interesting given it's not testament to the quality of the art itself. Do you feel it impacts how you collect your art?
Look, the galleries' pace has made formidable attempts to get into this space. My dear friend Adam Lindemann over at Venus over Manhattan has done drops for Art Blocks and many others. I don't think the house matters as much as the demand for these things. A lot of the collectors, the whale collectors, I'm not going to mention their names, they never set foot in a gallery or felt like they need to. They're collecting digital art. The whole experience of collection was transformed and disrupted in this new medium. So the middleman, be it a gallery or a dealer or an auction house, was irrelevant. They don't really care. However, with that said, I do believe that a Zancan or a Claire Silver selling through a Christie's auction will command a multiple that they might not otherwise get if they were doing their own manifold drop on OpenSea. And that's the power of the Christie's brand. It's centuries old. And even though they really don't play that heavily in this space, when they do anything around it, it's going to command the attention because of the brand and because of the marketing they'll put into it. And I bought the NFT at Christie's, But then there's a whole nother group of people that would never buy from Christie's, would only want to buy directly from the artist. Because one of the other tenets of blockchain, let's not forget, was to cut out the middleman and to go and to afford artists not being cheated out of their fair share of their art, be it music, art, film, or otherwise.
Obviously, a lot of discussion about how the art world and the blockchain art world connected with one another, because I think at the beginning, there was very much this almost adversarial relationship, because a lot of the dialogue was around, you know, the cutting out of the middleman. And then as time has progressed, it's been clear that there's actually a lot more of a symbiotic relationship that is taking place. But of course, as you mentioned, there's sort of like the loyalists that are in each camp. And it's changed the way in which people buy, collect, and perceive the value of art. So to talk about, you know, this is almost like a value gap between not just blockchain-based art, but also digital art and then physical art. How do you see those different levels or different types of art form being valued in both sort of a blockchain NFT lens and then the traditional art collector lens?
So we've had this discussion also, you and I, at least once before. The majority of physical art collectors, the people that are holding up paddles at Christie's and Sotheby's auctions, or the ones that are buying through their dealers, who collect art in the, you know, 10 million and above range, could really care about, don't care about NFTs at all. That's a fact. Maybe even, let's say, 5 million and up. But the folks that are, most of the NFT collectors buying in the high range are all crypto whales, or have been, looking to spend their crypto on something because they can't spend it otherwise. They can stake it. So this was an opportunity for those whales to buy something with crypto. And look, I have crypto. I get it. I'm bought in. I think it's going to happen, not if, but when. But that's the dynamic here that doesn't get talked about, I guess. All those whales, those folks weren't art collectors before. They found themselves with lots of money, and the two guys that bought the Beeple probably never bought a piece of art before that. So there's that. And then there's the masses, which could buy an NFT. But then there were those that were chasing this more because it's quick money, right? So the trajectory of Bored Apes went up, and oh my God, here's some quick money. And I'm not going to say Ponzi, but let's face it, that bubble burst real quick. They had, you know, but until then you had celebrities getting in, and it wasn't really about art. That was about culture and getting, making money and, you know, being cool. That had nothing to do with the art world, quite frankly. Let's face it. Mm. PFPs and collectibles still don't really have anything to do with the art world per se, but the Fidenzas and the Tyler Hobbs and the folks that are not the PFP collectible types. And look, I'm not saying someone's animation or cartoon is not art. I'm not saying that at all. Everything's art, okay? Everything is art. Let's just, you know, pure black paint, canvas, that's art, yes. And someone can explain it to you, and they'll blow your mind explaining that black square and what the intention of the artist was, and you'll sit there and you'll be blown away by that explanation, quite frankly. So let's not go there on what is art, but the dynamic of NFTs and digital art, I think it's all kind of settled and normalized now. And you've got people, I know whales still buying Jenny Passanins and Claire Silvers and Tyler Hobbs and Ben Kovacs's. My dear friend Lawrence Fuller, super talented guy, besides being an actor, he's adding poetry and beautiful AI art video that is art. There's no doubt Rafiq Anadol is not art, although our friend Jerry Saltz from the traditional art world, the critic, kind of had some negative comments about Rafiq recently, and Rafiq took the high road there because Rafiq's in MoMA, right? The beautiful exhibit. Now, by the way, that people sit in front of it on average for 90 minutes. I don't think people have stood in front of any physical piece of art in history for more than 30 minutes, let alone 90 on average. So if that's touching people at that volume, at that, for that tenure and that time frame, I'd say Rafiq is warranted to be up there with anybody else hanging at MoMA, but what do I know? So I think there's different intentions. There's collectors, there are art enthusiasts, but from the collector front, it's also about who collects what. Now, I personally do the same thing. When I go to someone's FX Hash account, or if I'm looking for new stuff to collect on FX Hash or object.com, I might go to Jason's wallet or Cosimo de Medici's wallet or Jenny or Claire. So I'll see what they're buying. And Jason speaks about this. Jason Bailey, Art Gnome, speaks about this all the time. That's part of the intention and behavior of collectors in this new world. They kind of look at what others buy. And that's how I found most of my new artists, by looking at who collects what. The other interesting dynamic in Tezos, probably more than Ethereum, is that the Tezos artists collect each other with great passion. Like Lawrence Fuller and Dolce and Claire and Zancan and Ren AI. And there's a whole, there's probably 50 of them. They collect each other's work. It's a wonderful thing, right? Because of that behavior of collectors come, and that's how you find out about other work, by looking at who's collecting what. So there's that dynamic as well, I think is interesting.
Yeah, looking at the collector dynamics is definitely fascinating, because as you said, there are so many different types of collectors, and we can't run away from the fact that it's not just within the blockchain art space, but the art space in like overall, is that speculative buying and speculative collecting is common on every single level. So it can't sort of be the primary criticism for what makes NFTs not art or to qualify as art. And I think what you said about the Tezos ecosystem in particular is true. There is a very much, is almost like this culture of supporting your fellow artists and supporting their work and their craft, and also elevating them so that they get more exposure, because at the end of the day, much of the work is stunning. It's visually compelling. It's thought-provoking. And I think what Tezos artists have done for one another is help illuminate one another's work so that people are exposed to it in ways that they perhaps wouldn't have been had they been on sort of the more prominent platforms. And also this sort of... the way in which collectors seek out the types of work they'd like to collect. It's almost, dare I say it, this, I don't want to say influencer, because I think influencer is a dirty word, but like you take the creative authority or the respect an artist holds, or like in their, or your respect for their judgment of art, as an indicator for where you should look next and the artist that you should then encounter as a bridge from that point. So there's almost like this referential system that's happening. And it's interesting to watch, because I don't think that's necessarily unique to the Tezos space, but I think it is one of the ways in which the Tezos ecosystem has become so major within the art space. Would you agree?
Well, again, the intentions are different. The Tezos collector is collecting art. I think the Tezos collector cares less about the valuation and the opportunity for gaining equity in the investment. Most of the Ethereum folks, it was a very different intention, especially with PFPs and collectibles. And then FOMO kicked in. And then the masses were jumping on blockchain and crypto just to get a piece of, you know, this get rich quick kind of thing with what happened. With these 10,000 PFP drops, that was just exhausting to watch, and the Twitter spaces and the club rooms with the discussions around the utility and the roadmaps, it was just a bit, you know, exhausting to watch. But we're back to art, and now a lot of those same folks, I think, that were chasing PFPs and collectibles, are now, I've seen a lot of them actually transition, and now they're appreciating the art for the artists, which is a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I think it was actually the discussion around PFPs was where you and I first connected, because we were very much aligned with the fatigue that came with the conversation about the utility of a PFP, the community that it was building, and the roadmap that they could enjoy as an owner of that PFP, and it sort of how it diluted the conversation around art for art's sake, and the fact that, you know, like you didn't need to have this intrinsic or inherent or almost profitable value off of the PFP to appreciate art for art's sake. So I think there's like an integrity there that was very much unique to watching Tezos collectors collect one another's work. It was not about the price. It was simply about either loving the artist or loving their work. But that was, you know, I think that was in 2021, 2022, where there was a lot of fervor around the space. But I do think that now attention is very finite and it is shifted very much to, you know, the rise of artificial intelligence and art. And in that respect, I wonder if the NFT conversation has died out a little. Do you think there's still a lot that's going on behind the scenes, or are people just a little bit more interested in the shiny new thing that's on the horizon?
So two things. First off, as you were speaking about the legacy PFP collectibles, I think I may have initially started the hashtag on Twitter, the art is the utility. You know, buy things that you, collectors don't really collect for gaining profit downstream. They usually collect because they want to own the art. They want to, there's a certain pride and of ownership. They want to show it off. They want to, so there's some utilities around that that I've seen pop up that are somewhat creative with merchandise and toys. Like Mumbot is an artist. I think she teeters on art and PFP collectibles and toys, and she's created merchandise. Jade, I think she's brilliant in that regard. There's other avenues you can get into here. I think brands like Nike and others in the Kering family on luxury retail, they've been dabbling. It's a huge digital marketing channel here. Let's face it. Not just about art. It's about engagement and conversion and retention of customers and customer experience that's fun and engaging. Even Starbucks is, you know, dabbling with reward programs that might be Web3 blockchain based and not just traditional stars on your app. I think the initial tenet and promise of blockchain as it relates to immutability and engagement and royalties downstream and all that stuff, I think is still very viable now that we're past this PFP craze for sure. You mentioned AI. So I think it's a interesting topic relative to this discussion. I don't think the Gen AI buzz, which is only like 7 months old, if you really think about it, that Lenza mobile app, and then ChatGPT dropping, that was kind of the start of it, right? December last year, January. So this whole Gen AI thing is only 7 months old, which is kind of hard to believe relative to the intense demand as a technologist, as a professional services provider, my current firm, and just the VC demand, the valuations, the fundraising around Gen AI. I think Gen AI has infiltrated the art world significantly, and that discussion needs to be had. I mean, I think artists and creatives were the last role that people would have thought AI would have affected. I think people would have assumed the lawyers and the doctors and the accountants and tax professionals might have been impacted first. It's interesting that the artists and musicians and now actors and scriptwriters are getting impacted first. That's an interesting discussion for another time. But I think a lot of artists who are already dabbling with AI before Gen AI, like Von Doyle and Claire Silver and Lawrence Fuller, that were using GAN tools before it became much easier with Midjourney and now Runway, those folks were so ahead of the curve. And now they're somewhat, you know, battling. I know Claire is constantly defending her position as an artist in the community. Boy, Claire's like, Claire Silver, like, someone typing in a prompt and then getting an image out from Midjourney without any post-production editing, is that art? I don't know. Maybe. I guess it is. I didn't do anything except type in purple squirrel running through Wall Street, and I'll get a cool purple squirrel running through Wall Street with a funny hat. Whatever. It's fun. It's engaging. Is it art? I don't know. But you got to realize these artists are not just doing that. These artists are treating it. They're getting the output from Midjourney or DALL-E 2 or Stability. And then they're going through their thing, and their thing may include hours of Blender and ZBrush and Adobe Suite products that are being treated. They're creating art. So the output from the AI is just one step in that process. They are very much artists. And I think that discussion is an interesting one on the intellectual property, obviously the copyright one as well. A lot of folks believe that their art might be being scraped and therefore it's being copied. the devil is in the detail on that one, in my humble opinion. I think you need to understand how the AI creates the image, how it learns. Mm-hmm. Yes, the AI engine may have scanned every image on the internet at one point, and it's created its own corpus of that information. But when you type in a prompt and the AI engine algorithm creates a net new image, it's not exactly a copy of anything. It is a net new image. So the devil's in the detail on how that GAN model works to truly appreciate whether this is copyright infringement or not. And I guess case law and, you know, legal will ultimately determine that determination on copyright or not. And not just for images, right? For text, for music, for everything AI creates, it had to get a seed from something, whether an original piece of something, whether it's a book or a script or an image or a photo or a film. Because video is coming now. Runway is killing it with their image-to-video processing. You can take any image and you can create a video, 4 seconds worth of it. It's tremendous. And this is just the beginning. Like, where we'll be in 5 years is going to be very disruptive to the entertainment media industry, which is why they're obviously on strike right now. One of the key issues there is just about that. But it's an interesting time for sure. From, again, the AI, I know I went on a tangent here, but I think the AI discussion within the art world is one that's worthy of discussion.
I think another very prominent name that sprung to mind as you were listing off, you know, AI empowered artist is also Sasha Styles and her blockchain poetry. And I remember at the onset of all of these sort of generative AI tools for the masses, as it were, Sasha was very vocal online about not only how it didn't dilute the quality of art, but then this was something that existed within the art world for a long time, actually, and that many had sort of failed to recognize and failed to acknowledge the true value of much earlier on. But what I think was also very interesting for her to touch upon was that there is this sort of AI and blockchain relationship. There's almost a dance that's happening between these two technologies. And it's interesting to see how they're sort of coming together, especially as it relates to the creator economy. So I wanted to ask you your perspective on whether you feel there's a natural synergy between these technologies and what it looks like.
It goes back to the question, what is art, be it music, film, you know, painting, sculpture, art? I think Billy Corgan said it best. Smashing Pumpkins, have you heard of that band? He was discussing AI and music. He said art is discernment, which was very profound to me when he said that. 5 years from now, we will be creating net new content, be it a script or a book or a film or an image. And I think there's a democratization happening, where as opposed to maybe just the media companies creating content, everyone can. I think there's a next step. This whole generative AI thing is a stepping stone towards what's next after it, just like the internet was this thing. And I witnessed it firsthand. No one knew what it was. What is this information superhighway? Let's block it. Every company blocked it, by the way. Like, they blocked ChatGPT when they first found out people were using it. And then look what happened with the internet thing. So it's the same dynamics, the same naysayers, the same regulatory government intervention. The same dynamics are occurring with generative AI that occurred during the internet. So I think it's the next wave of what's going to be built on top of this that's going to be really impactful and, I think, change everything as we know it in work and life.
Just as a point of note, I definitely have heard of the Smashing Pumpkins. My father introduced me to Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness when I was a young girl. And I think it was the first time I realized I was very much into the moody, sort of angsty type of music. But I completely agree with you. And I think what would be interesting to see, or interesting to get your perspective on, is what the main challenges and opportunities are there are in this space. Because as you said, as with many new technologies, there's always this initial wave of resistance. There's this, until we understand how this is going to impact us, we don't truly want to engage with it, should there be any cost or risk. But what are those risks that you think, you know, these institutions are afraid of, and what are the opportunities that they could really be seizing here?
Of Gen AI specifically, or AI in general? I think organizations are very frightened by the notion of being able to capture the entire knowledge management of your company into one corpus, one data set, if you will, which IT, the technology departments, there's disparate systems. There's an ERP system, there's an accounting system, there's an HR system. They're all kind of disconnected. And then former CIOs like myself would basically build data and analytics tools that they could query these systems using AI in some cases. This Gen AI thing basically takes everything in the company, every 10K, every 10Q, every invoice, every term sheet, everything can be captured, scraped, and fed into one large corpus data set and then queried. And it could fit on a thumb drive, by the way. So that's a pretty scary notion for the same concerns around data protection and privacy and intellectual property. This makes it that it exasperates the risk is what it does. So companies like KPMG, not to do a plug here, but we have a practice that works with companies, the largest, in fact, to help them with responsible AI, which puts guardrails around the queries and making sure that your intellectual property is not being released to the public domain, which, by the way, can very easily happen if it's not architected properly. So there's a lot of ancillary things that have to happen that I think the consumerization of ChatGPT, people think it's just a mobile app, when the enterprise needs to look at it very differently because the risks are very, very significant. So I think that's also a topic of discussion, and that's why I think companies are somewhat concerned. But there's, it's still early. It's been 7 months, really, that this Gen AI thing dropped, and I've never seen, and no one has ever seen the trajectory, again, of VC fundraising and valuations and demand from clients for what is it and how can we use it. It's unprecedented.
It's funny because it sounds like to me that so many of these companies are fearing with the sort of ubiquity of AI at the moment is all of their information being centralized, which is sort of like the principle of the blockchain and the decentralization of all of that information so that there isn't a single point of failure or threat to all of that data. So it's interesting to see how those attitudes are sort of coming together in almost a, wouldn't call it a complementary fashion, but there's definitely one reflecting back upon the other. I'm mindful of your time, so I would love to end off with a question more to on a personal level about what the latest innovations that you are seeing are that you're particularly excited about as it relates to generative AI, as it relates to blockchain, and sort of what vision of the world you see us going into going forward.
On the blockchain front, we just recently conducted a symposium out in Park City. We had some of the greatest thought leaders in this space. Scott Stornetta, the founder, co-founder of blockchain, was there, and a few other founders. I think blockchain is finally starting to be considered as a viable technology. The state of California is now using blockchain for DMV records. They're testing other government agencies are starting to look at it, where you need immutable record keeping. And, I think it's a great use case. It has a performance issue. Let's face it, blockchain is not going to... It has a serious transaction per second problem and limitation I think it needs to overcome first. So with that said, I think the opportunity for blockchain is only getting started now that we're past this NFT PFP craze. On the Gen AI front, the applications, depending on the sector, from healthcare to legal to entertainment media, we've got to get through these hurdles of risk and concern around risk and data protection. We've got to get through this copyright infringement discussion and people's work being scraped in order to feed the models. But I think the opportunity for AI as it relates to the democratization and decentralization of things, look, companies' competitive advantage is their intellectual property. Let's face it. Maybe the public sector should be maybe more transparent using the technologies than private sector per se, but it's still early. I think there's one more buzz that's starting to get some steam that you're going to hear a lot more about in the next 2-3 years. It's quantum computing. It's finally not like this future cold fusion thing. I think quantum is real. IBM just made some significant announcements around it. I think quantum computing applied to Gen AI and what it does to compute processing capabilities could be significant. But this is all very early. I think government intervention is a double-edged sword on that front. But it's a wildly exciting time to be in tech and innovation for me. And I'll just keep collecting my Tezos artworks, and follow me on Twitter if you want to check out my collection. I usually, again, celebrate the purchase, not because I'm bragging, but I want to get the word out to help the artist. Part of the Tezos collector is to promote the artist and the art, which is what art collecting is about. At the end of the day.
I love that you sort of wear two hats as it comes to your role as a technologist and understanding how institutions are responding to things like blockchain technology, generative AI, or AI and AI overall for that matter, as well as quantum computing, which has sort of just been under the surface for a very long time and is sort of waiting for its breakthrough moment, in the same way that we have seen for blockchain, in the same way we have seen for AI. So, and then coupling that with, you know, how you collect art on a day-to-day level as a personal hobby, as a personal interest and a personal passion. So it's I love seeing how all of those levels interact with one another, because the one very much informs the other. Richard, this has been a fascinating conversation. I think you and I could talk for hours, as we have done in the past, about how all of these technologies are changing the way that we interact and how we behave in our daily lives. But I think we'll have to save it for another time. Before we go, you mentioned your Twitter handle. Do you want to tell our audience what that is so that they know where to find you? And then we will sign out from there.
On the professional front, it's you can find me on LinkedIn. My Twitter handle is my last name, Entrop, at Entrop. Easy, very easy to find.
Perfect. Well, Richard, thank you so much again for sharing all of your thoughts and perspectives. And I'm sure we will have another conversation very soon.
Great to see you, Marissa. Thank you.
Bye.